Hi, thanks for joining us today. This is Bonnie Wallace, author of The Hollywood Parents Guide. And today my guest on Hometown to Hollywood is Jessica Rhodes. Jessica is a producer of both film and television. She's produced many diverse film and TV projects, including Eye Candy, Young and Hungry, Cold Case Files, Cloud Nine, Spectacular, and Beauty in the Briefcase. And she is currently producing Sharp Objects, starring Amy Adams, for HBO, and she has two pilots lined up to produce this fall, Tremors for Sci-Fi and Run for Your Life for USA. Jessica, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much.
So let's just cut to the chase. How did you get started as a producer?
Really early. When I was still an undergrad at UCLA, my brother, who's a writer-director, was producing a short film, and he needed help. And I was available and organized and nice, which tend to be my traits as a producer. Still to this day, I feel like that's what I trade in. And I just genuinely jumped in to help him. And a couple shorts later for him and also a couple other people, and shorts that went to Sundance and Aspen and Edinburgh and kind of did the film festival circuit, I realized how much I loved it and ended up graduating undergrad early to pursue producing. And it's always been about writers for me. Like, it's about the script and helping them execute their vision and getting it onto the screen.
Yeah. I love that. I come from a writing background myself, mm-hmm. and I am of the very firm opinion that writing is what makes or breaks a project. And it's very interesting because people tend to think it's all about the actors. Mm-hmm. Great actors can't do very much if the script isn't solid. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no. I mean, I think it's why it's you know, now everyone's in TV, but I got to TV early. I kind of figured I enjoyed TV more than film earlier than most. I think I figured that out. And I think on some subconscious level, it was because I gravitate towards writers, mm-hmm. and I like the amount of say and sway and control writers have in television. Mm-hmm. That really speaks to me. It's obviously a very collaborative medium, but I think showrunners obviously have the role in TV that people attribute to directors in features.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that feels right to me.
It's interesting. I don't think that's widely known, that writers have a lot more control in TV than they do in film.
Yeah, I mean, in traditional television, like, you know, this fancy age of television we're in right now, but in traditional television, you know, the showrunner created the show, hired a fantastic, amazing, visionary director to come in and help build what the world looks like, help cast the actors, help decide what it looked like, what it walked and talked like. But then that director would go away and a different director would come in each episode, and the singular voice that remains is that of the showrunner. You know, even those rooms of writers, those incredibly talented writers who are brought in to execute the show, are trying to write the voice of the showrunner.
That's right. You know, that's really interesting. I had not thought about, okay, you've got a single director, obviously, with the movie from start to finish. Mm-hmm. But again, this is maybe something that people don't know. I didn't know this before we got involved, but it is the normal thing to cycle directors through, like, either every episode they change or every several they change.
Yeah, or block shoot, so you, mm-hmm. like, roll through multiple episodes. But yeah, no, I mean, really, this new vanguard of premium television is bringing feature directors to television who are saying, I have the stamina. Really, it's a stamina game to go 8 hours. I have the stamina. I mean, if you think about how crazy that is, it's amazing. I mean, think about the amount of work and energy and effort a director puts into a 2-hour movie or a 90-minute movie, and now multiply that. It's very difficult to direct 8 episodes of television. So when you look at, you know, True Detective, or you look at what Jean-Marc did with Big Little Lies, and now what he's doing with Sharp Objects, it's a feat. I mean, it is a marathon.
It is a marathon, and I think about that when I look at it from an actor standpoint. You know, these actors on on movies, they tend to be longer days, mm-hmm. you know, really, really, really long days. And then I look at the director, it's like, well, the director was here when the actors showed up.
Yeah.
And the director was here when they left. It's like, they're putting in at least as much and frankly, a little bit more on each end of the margin. Yeah. The same with the producers. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's.
Well, sometimes I get there after the actor's already been in makeup.
All right, well, okay. but that's a TV thing, too. I mean, TV tends to have a little more, I don't know, like, life-friendly hours. It depends on the show.
Yeah. I mean, that's why a lot of people in Los Angeles years ago gravitated towards television. I know a lot of producers, like, working producers, like, line producers and production, you know, producers who... got involved in television because it shot in LA and you could get on a show where you had a call time of 9 a.m. and you were wrapped by 6.
And you could have dinner with your family and sleep in your own bed at night and not be away from everybody for 3 months. Yeah.
Yeah. And now we have some shows that aren't civilized.
No, they're not. Like the call time is 4 a.m. and you're technically in LA, but only technically.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, Now people are letting us call it art. For a while, people wouldn't say that about TV, even though it was, darn it.
It was, and we were talking about that earlier, you know, the kind of, I really love this, you know, it wasn't that long ago that it was very, very siloed, and the worlds of film, and the worlds of TV, and the worlds of Broadway, you know, or let's just say stage, mm-hmm. you know, great stage acting, were... They never touched those worlds, and the actors didn't cross over, and the writers didn't cross over. Mm-hmm. But there's a true, like, kind of renaissance, I think, now where talent is talent.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And there's a lot of crossover, and I've noticed, like, so for example, with our story, you know, I've got a kid who fell in love with musical theater, as so many young actors do. And for a little while, in her mind, it was like, you know, well, do I think about film and TV? Film and TV, like it's one thing, film and TV.
Yeah.
Or do I think about Broadway? But in fact, there's so much Broadway-ish stuff moving into film and TV that you can, if you can make a name for yourself through film and TV as someone who could do musical theater, as these amazing live productions are doing,
yeah,
then that's like a path to Broadway, and it's a lot of back and forth.
Yeah, I think it's a time in entertainment across the board where people are looking at talented writers and directors and actors and saying, are you trained for this? Like, are you trained to entertain people? Are you experienced at what it takes to do the work? And everything else they can kind of teach. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't understand how Broadway works or you don't understand how television works, you know, we can figure that part out with you. But do you have the pure talent? I think that's like the thing. I mean, I think that Broadway is probably better training ground in terms of stamina for film and TV than maybe traditional television is for Broadway.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, 8 shows a week is not a joke.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you've really got to, you know. But I think that, and we were talking about, there's definitely been an impressive migration to television, mm-hmm. More than we've ever seen. And I think you see it in writers and directors. Something happened a couple years ago where it went from, you know, I can't remember who it was. I mean, McConaughey doing True Detective felt like a biggie because he just won the Oscar. Like, it, you know, it felt this was someone at the top of his game choosing to do something in television. Mm-hmm. Whereas before, I mean, there were definitely some others around that time, but I think before that, to be honest, and this says something about the roles that there were for women, really what you were seeing was, for the past, like, 10 years prior, was incredibly talented women having roles no longer written for them in features, finding exquisitely written roles that were deeper, more interesting characters than they'd ever seen in features exist in television. That was the old migration.
That was the first migration. I remember reading articles about that, like people going, oh my gosh, these gigantic female film stars are invading TV.
Yeah.
You know?
And they were saying again and again and again, which is true, these characters. It's about this character. I've never seen a character like this. You know, I'm not being relegated to someone's whatever. And that was really interesting. And then I think a lot of actors realized how exciting it was to get to spend more time with a character, really develop a character. And at the same time, drama disappeared from the theatrical marketplace. I think Jason Blum always would say that, you know, it was kind of the Marvel-sized movies, and then the Blumhouse, you know, like low-budget tier movies. And then in the middle, that dramas just couldn't survive anymore. It's very few and far between. The Oscar nominees and kind of nothing else. Mm-hmm. And it's because those are now in television.
But they can be in television.
Or they're in television because they're no longer
Yeah,
there.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is that?
Yeah.
But it is exciting. And from a creative standpoint, whether you're an actor or a producer or a writer or a director, any of the different, you know, parts of the food chain, to be able to, you know, get your teeth into something for more than the equivalent of, you know, what, 90 or 120 minutes worth of exploration.
Yeah.
There's only so much arc you can build in that amount of time, regardless of your storytelling and editing skills.
Yeah, it's really exciting.
So, yay, TV. And now you're doing, you're currently doing Sharp Objects, and that's based on a book.
It's based on Gillian Flynn's first novel. Gillian wrote Gone Girl and Dark Places. This was her first novel, and it's also the novel, which I love, that she says that the most of her fans and most people ask what's happened to the character since, which we were very lucky. Marty Noxon, like, created this exquisite adaptation. The first season is the book, and there's room together that the ladies have created for the series to continue beyond for subsequent seasons. So we're really excited.
That's exciting. Well, and it's a short season, right? It's
8 episodes.
8 episodes, which is kind of neat. I mean, people are watching things in binges. Like, you might watch the whole thing in a weekend.
Yeah.
Our viewing habits are changing.
They're really changing, although it's funny. I go hot cold personally on binging.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that HBO still premieres new episodes on Sunday nights. So, yes, people will catch up on HBO Go, or people will catch up, and at a certain point, you know, but if you're doing your job well, knock on wood, people are showing up for appointment television. They know that they have to watch it on Sunday night because people are going to be talking about it on Monday. You know, people are going to be tweeting about it, the social media of it all, spoilers aplenty, and if you are watching a show or a fan of a show that comes out weekly, you better be watching it. And I think that's neat. That's what I love about one of the things I love about television.
I was just reading somewhere, it was like a little online poll, like, how many people need to watch Game of Thrones in utter silence? And I thought, yeah, that speaks to the kind of, like, immense, what, focus and engagement that's going on with television.
Absolutely.
It's exciting.
Yeah, and I think that it's, as television evolves, and by the way, I produce streaming series. I think they're magnificent. I think binging is really exciting and fun and cool too. And I watched all of 13 Reasons. I was up way too late. We were shooting in Georgia, and I thought I'd watch an episode or two because my friend, you know, I'm friendly with the producers, and there I was at 4 a.m. cursing them because I was still watching. So I mean, it's great, but I think that something that still exists in television as it evolves as this art form and as everyone migrates to it without judging it for being TV anymore, you know, that's gone. What's still, I think, there is that water cooler-ness, and I think it's amplified by social media. And I think what sometimes gets lost with bingeable shows, and I'm trying to crack this as a producer myself, thinking about how you crack it, I don't have the answer, is there's certain series, I always go back to the first season of House of Cards, where you couldn't talk about it with anyone because you didn't know where they were.
Mm.
Because you didn't know what episode something would happen. You'd have watched the whole season and someone was like, oh, I'm in the middle. But you didn't know it was the middle four, is the middle five, is the middle six. Like, where's the middle? Mm-hmm. And you'd be like, has this happened yet? And you'd ask because you didn't want to spoil something else, so you were saying something kind of mundane. And they'd say no, and you'd be like, oh, okay. And you'd kind of be just trying to figure out, you realize you couldn't talk. You couldn't socialize about a show. And I think people love to socialize about shows.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm still trying to crack on premium on streaming television. How do you, unless you watch the entire season, how do you talk about it?
Yeah. That's interesting.
Because we like to.
And that's not an issue for movies. You've either seen it or you haven't.
Right.
You know, pretty much.
Once in a while, you're like, I saw Half on a Plane.
Yeah. Actually, somebody just told me they'd seen half of Descendants 2, and I'm like, how did you...
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. It better have been the second half.
But the second half's the better half. Of course it wasn't the second half. All right. You're not my friend anymore. Well, so we met mm-hmm. on the set of a movie,
yeah.
Cloud Nine. We were figuring out how long ago that was. Like, Dove was 17. She turned 17 on set, so she was 16, actually. She's 21 now. Seems like a million years ago, but it was so cool. And it was one of my first experiences seeing, you know, what a producer does on the ground, mm-hmm. hands-on. And, of course, I didn't get to see most of what you were doing, but I saw you in the snow,
yeah,
like on the ground, literally making things work and making things happen. So that's kind of what a lot of it looks like, right? It's not just hearing pitches and looking at scripts. A lot of it is like bundling up and being there next to the director.
Yeah, it depends on what kind of producer you are. I mean, there's definitely producers who enjoy different portions of the process more than others. But, you know, I think that for me, like I said, it goes back to the script and back to the writer and helping them execute their vision. And so for a lot of shows, you're there for the pilot. You're there to really solve, both ask and answer questions. You know, figure out, shooting a pilot, traditionally, hopefully you're creating a roadmap for a very long series. And so it's everything from what it looks like to what it feels like, I know that's a weird, but it like, mm-hmm. but yeah. It feels like to watch it or to, you know, be in the world and to cast the actors and to understand who those characters are and to figure out what the relationships are and the chemistry. I mean, chemistry is real. Like it either is there, it's there, or it's not. And so being there, deciding what the locations are and deciding what the sets look like and all of that stuff. So most producers are there for all of that in a pilot.
You'd want that control if you're going to be producing.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, producing isn't about control, but it's about making sure that the writer is being able to accomplish what they set out to do with the aid of the director, and that what they're setting out to accomplish also works for the network, who is going to spend a lot of money and work very hard making sure their audience can find it, can, I know that sounds funny, but like in this world, it can find it, can actually find it and then enjoy it. So there's a lot of moving pieces and a lot of points of view, and so it's really being in the middle and balancing all that. And then it just depends. Sometimes a producer is there for all of production. I have been for Sharp Objects. I've been for a lot of my projects. And then sometimes, you know, it's shooting in Vancouver or it's shooting in New York and you're in LA unless there's a reason you need to be there.
Yeah, then you probably get on a plane periodically, but you can manage a lot of it from here. You're talking about chemistry and I was thinking and noise, and I was thinking about that. Like, you know, when I was growing up, there just weren't that many channels to choose from. It was pre-cable. Now there's more channels and more options and non-channels even with all the online stuff than anybody can possibly even count. And so the noise is crazy, and so chemistry is more important than ever in a way, because that's part of what compels us to watch something.
Yeah.
You know, we watch for that chemistry between the characters, for that sense of urgency and engagement, you know, that we just can't turn away from, like you were watching till 4 a.m, something that was just that compelling, even though you knew you needed to go to bed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why the stakes feel so high right now with television. I think it's great. The tides rise. You know, everyone kind of does even better work than they already were doing. I think with this much, I mean, all the time I'm driving down the street and I see a billboard for a show that I have never heard of, and it's in its second season. That's strange for me.
And
it's,
you're in the business.
Yeah,
so you really
this is what
think
I do
you know about it.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's the first time in my career where when I run into a friend at a restaurant or at a party and they say the show they're doing and I have to admit I haven't seen it, that used to be really offensive.
Yeah.
And now people are like, yeah, I get it. Like,
there's just too much.
There's too much.
Yeah.
So I think more than ever, and by the way, we're no different than the audience at home. You know, everyone's experiencing that. So, yeah, I think it is more important than ever that, for me, from a creative standpoint, I hope I'm telling a story that no one's told before, that doesn't feel familiar, that doesn't feel like something they could have gotten somewhere else or have gotten somewhere else before or could get currently on mm-hmm. another show.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that becomes part of the reason that you show up and watch the first couple episodes to give it a shot. And then once you're there, yeah, it is so much about whether you attach to the actors and whether you want to spend your time with them. Even if they're playing bad people. I don't think there's, you know, we've had plenty of examples of anti-heroes that people attach to. There's just, I think that the chemistry is not only between the actors on the screen, but that feeling you have
between you.
You and, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What is it? What is that? I think it comes from theater, but something like that the audience doesn't go to theater to see you feeling something. They go so that they can feel something. You know?
Yeah.
I'm mangling it, but that's no, but the idea.
I think you're absolutely right. I think you're absolutely right. And I think that it's, you know, I think some of the feels were always playing with too much, too little, too much, too little. Is that too much, too little? Like uncomfortable. People love to feel uncomfortable to a point.
To a point.
And then they do not feel comfortable. And that's when I look at things like, you know, my husband, he's not going to like, my husband doesn't like Curb Your Enthusiasm. Like that makes, that anxious feeling that you have watching is not a good one for him. He's got an ounce of it on Veep. He's surmounted. It's surmountable. He can watch Veep. I love Veep. Like I love that oh feeling. But I think stress is something people feel. I think stress is really like one of the biggest emotions people feel because that's kicking in and like thriller and that's kicking in drama and that's kicking in, you know, even romance. But then I think there's just, yeah. Like, when you start rooting for a character, there's a note that people hate to get in Hollywood, which is likable.
Ew.
Is the character likable?
Yeah.
But I think the note under that note is, will we root for them? Because I think that is critical. You know, the lead, Amy Adams' character in Sharp Objects, is really dark, and she's going through a lot, and she makes some decisions that you wouldn't want your child to make, and she's not the person that you'd want your child to be, but you never give up hope for her, and I think that's on the page. I think that was on the page in Gillian's book. I think that's on the page in Marty's script, and Amy with John Mark, like, it is 100% on the screen. And I think that just plain rooting for characters is like, I'm going back to Veep. Julie Louis-Dreyfus, like Selena Myers is so ridiculous. And you're oddly rooting for her and her team. That's chemistry. Mm-hmm. I think between the show and its characters and its actors and its writing and its directing and the audience.
It's a lot of different pieces that make that all work. So thinking about that and thinking that, you know, a lot of the listeners of this podcast are actors or want to be actors. You know, there's a lot of anxiety around casting.
Yeah.
You know, and so when you're casting for something, you know, you're not a casting director, but producers are typically involved at some level with mm-hmm. casting. What are you guys looking for?
Well, it's funny. I mean, now I feel like I'm beating the same drum, but I want to attach to the character,
mm-hmm.
and I want to root for them. And so it's if I'm watching an audition, for me, it does come down to like whether I believe it. It's like that true is, am I watching a real person? Have they made this character come off the page, but not so far off the page that it doesn't feel real?
Yeah.
And if it's, you know, if it's one of our central characters, as opposed to a, you know, clearly an antagonist or clearly a, you know, there are no small roles, but a small,
yeah,
you know,
but kind a guest star, a guest co-star star. Is going to have different considerations for casting than, yeah. Than a series regular.
Absolutely. And I think that there's just, you, I remember every single leading actor, I can remember meeting them. And by that I mean, like, watching their tape or when they came into, like, I actually can, if I go back, I can remember because I attach to them. You just do. So it is truly about, being present,
mm-hmm.
and finding a way. I think you have to believe your character fundamentally. I mean, I'm not an actor, and there are people who are far more expert at it than I do, but when I talk to actors on set who have managed to ground moments that I'm blown away that they made feel so real, they talk about their preparation. They talk about what they've done to just believe that character and be in that moment with that character. And I think that that's what you can buy in an audition. That's what you can figure out.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I think people fall in love with actors because they make them feel something.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't make anybody feel anything if you don't believe what you're doing.
Totally.
It has to be real to you.
Yeah.
What are some of the more challenging things about producing a TV show or a movie, and what are some of the more enjoyable things?
That's the hardest thing, kind of the sense of you could use more time on every step. Features, for the most part, you know, finish the script, and then they go shoot. And yes, the script often changes while you're shooting, but, like, everyone's been able to look at a single document and know what's ahead of them.
Right.
And in television, one of the hardest things, and why I think everyone working, like, the crew's working in television, and the writer's working in television, and then the directors, episodic directors, actors, everyone is working with material coming in all the time. So they're as prepared as you can possibly be for who knows what, you know, and then they roll with it, and I think that flexibility is amazing. It oddly, I think that's one of my favorite things about what I get to do. I love people who make television. I love people who make entertainment in general, but it's like everywhere else in the world, people tell you no. Even in the development stage, people tell you no. No one says no in production. They tell you it'll cost more. And you can decide whether or not you can afford it. But, like, if you're remodeling a house, people are going to tell you why you can't have things. If people, you know, if you're, I don't know, building a menu, people are going to tell you why you can't. Like, everywhere else I feel like in the world, like, it's okay for someone to be like, no, you can't have that thing you want. And it's amazing to me that if tomorrow morning Marty Noxon said, I want this, or Jean-Marc Vallée said, I want this, someone would make it happen. That's magical.
It is. It's really,
and I really
the
love
ultimate
that.
Yes and.
Yeah.
Because it's this huge act of co-creative improv, right?
Totally. But it's amazing when you think about what, I mean, movie magic is so fun. And that's my favorite part.
I think about the props people. You know,
oh,
they get a script with, like, no time at all to literally, like, create something that doesn't exist because it's necessary for the storyline, and they do it.
Oh, yeah.
It's incredible.
Oh, yeah. It's nuts.
It's so inspiring.
Every once in a while, Jean-Marc yesterday asked for something, and Hope, our prop master, was like, let me see what's on the truck. And she came back, and he loved it, and she was, I mean, it's just, you know, she pulled it off. They're amazing. They always pull it off.
Yeah, it's heroic. It's really fun. What were you studying in school when you were, so you were in college.
I was at UCLA.
When you began
mm-hmm.
producing, which is super cool. But were you in like the film department or?
Yeah, no, I hadn't figured that out yet. I wasn't. I was in the English department. I was an English major with a focus in American Lit and Culture and a minor in Greek and Roman studies. I didn't finish the minor because I graduated early to pursue producing. But I did go back to the master's program. I got an MFA in producing.
Wow.
That was for my mom, so I could teach if it all didn't work out.
Shout out to mom and plan B.
By the way, like who's 22-year-old says they want to be a producer? You know, my mom didn't even know what that was. Most people's moms don't know what a producer does. But I think that, my brother wanted to be a writer-director. So he was the kid with the camcorder. He was the kid who was making movies with his friends and, you know, putting ketchup on me and having the dog lick it off his blood. You know, like an attack dog. That was him. I just was always the person who wanted to support that person, which sounds passive, but it just was what I loved. I loved the feeling of someone else with a vision and you helping them jump through the fire and the hurdles and, you know, and then as I actually figured out what it was, I loved, and this is what I do to this day, but being able to say, here, you know, here in this circle are all the things that only you can do. Outside that circle is everything that needs to get done. So let me just do everything else that needs to get done to support you and take that off your plate so you can focus on the creative stuff that only you can do.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is how I've always looked at working with writers. So no one else can write this character. No one else can figure out exactly. We can all have notes. We can all contribute. We can all do all that. But, like, no. This is yours to create. And you, no one else can do that part. So, you know, going and solving that issue over there or going and working out that schedule problem there or listening to that person who has, you know, a genuine concern, I can do that. And then I can be the one to moderate when they have access to your brain because I can say, you know, I remember doing this series that was shooting in New York, and the network was always asking for, which is their job, you know, but something that was a couple episodes down the line. And that writer couldn't focus on both things at once. And that makes perfect sense. And so it was a lot of saying, okay, we need to ask questions about 103 today, not 107. I promise we'll get you answers on 107 tonight. It's just, you know, that's stupid stuff. But if you're not doing it, you're not protecting that person from what they need to accomplish that morning. And so that's my big, that to me, every producer does it differently, but that's always like, I wake up in the morning on all my shows and think, what can I take off their plate today? So that way they can do the thing that no one else here can do.
That's beautiful. Well, that's a highly creative position, actually. It is sort of like the ultimate, you know, you're shepherding the project through.
Yeah, I mean, I like to think that it's more like, you know, protecting them from the onslaught of questions, because that's what being a writer or being a director is. It's just questions all day long. And so allowing, you know, them to, I can't always stop everything from hitting people. Sometimes I'm just a speed bump that slows down the hit. You know, like I'm a little padding. But, you know, I just love them all. It's so cheesy, but like I fall in love with writers and I want to support them. I want to do what it takes.
Well, and you're that way on set with everybody. I mean, you know, way back during Cloud Nine, I mean, you were protecting the actors. You were protecting everybody. I mean, that was just something you were clearly very much about, and it was, it's not always the case. Not all producers take on that role. So, you know, as the mom of an actor, I was noticing and appreciating that.
Oh, well, I mean, it's the mom in me too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of, you've done a lot of really different projects all across the board, but it has included some for Disney and Nick.
Yeah.
Any advice for young actors?
I mean, we were talking about this earlier. I think making sure you have the right support system seems so critical. You will have a different relationship with your parents than quote-unquote normal kids. That's the one thing that feels like, and maybe all kids have different relationships than what relationships looked like when I was growing up because of how we communicate and how we whatever, but when I look at the kids who, you know, I mean, it's so fond reminiscing about Cloud Nine because it's Dove, but it's also Kiersey, and, you know, Kiersey, we got to turn around and work together on Eye Candy, and now she's an adult, and it's incredible, and she's working with, you know, Victoria Justice on Eye Candy, who I worked together with on Spectacular when she was such a baby, and, you know, watching all these incredible people grow up, and, you know, more often than not, there are obvious exceptions to every rule, but more often than not, the kids that make it, the kids that turn into adults, that still are working and loving it, have really good relationships with their parents. And I can't help but think that that has something to do with it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's advice, I think, for parents and kids, you know, mm-hmm. making sure you have the right relationship, I'd assume, before you went in. Because it's not going to make it better.
It doesn't make it easier. I can, you know, I mean, obviously we're a success story, but I can still say that. It does not make anything easier.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think surrounding yourself with people you can trust, because somehow not only actors today, because of the onslaught of social media, we're talking about kind of how much access people have to them, but all of a sudden there's all these other people in your lives from, who are your bosses, by the way. Like, so they have a legitimate right to be telling you what to do.
But that's how that works.
Yeah. Like, it's real.
Yeah.
But I think it gives you, especially at a certain age, when you're still trying to figure out who you are and trying to make decisions about your career, what is that foundation? Is that from your family and your friends, but is that a manager you really trust? Is that a you know, an agent that you really trust, that you can look at careers of other people that you respect? And because I will say, there are absolutely managers and agents who I trust more when they call than others.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's fair to look at other people's careers and say they're doing something right. Maybe it's some people working with them.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Well, and I think the same way, but it's good to hear that come out of the mouth of a producer.
Yeah.
Because that helps you make certain decisions.
I think it's true. And then I think, be willing to do the work. I think everything, even producing, is experience. We were talking earlier about how I just feel like you get, the more you're in situations, the better you become at it. There's the Malcolm Gladwell Outliers, you know, 10,000 hours.
I love Malcolm Gladwell.
But it's like the idea that, you know, even prodigies were just people who got to 10,000 hours earlier. And I think for younger people getting into acting, it's not an overnight thing. You will get better at it. And it's about, I don't know the art of acting. I can't give any advice on the art of it. I can just say, it seems to me that people get better with time. And so actually taking class, actually studying, actually rehearsing, whatever you can get your hands on, whether it's Mala, whatever, it just feels like if you can log 10,000 hours, you'll be better than when you had 10 hours. And so I think there does seem to be a sense that I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And if she can do that, I can do that. And yeah, some people come off the truck really talented. It just is what it is. But even those people will be more talented in 10,000 hours.
Well, and if they love it, they want to do it.
Right.
So, you know, it's not a big burden to do that. Well, then, any advice for parents who are hoping to help their kids succeed in this industry? Because you, when you are producing any kind of project, you inevitably deal with parents kids. Because parents are part of the deal if you hire a kid.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the great things about Hollywood now is that we have studio teachers who are responsible also for the welfare of children. So I think that there's someone on every set that hopefully parents can align with, and parents can make sure that the needs of their children are being met, and that they have someone that they can safely speak up to. I would like to think on every set that you can safely speak up if you're a parent, but not everyone feels comfortable, and that person was put in place because not only are they hopefully keeping an eye out for everything, but if you have a concern, you can raise it. So I think, you know, I think making sure you feel like your child's safe is fundamental. Because, by the way, adult experienced actors can't do their best work if they don't feel safe, if they don't feel prepared. So to ask, and adult, mature grown-ups have trouble raising their hand and saying, I feel uncomfortable. So how can we ask a young person to do that? So I do think for a young person, you know, for a parent with a young actor, I think following proper channels, but speaking up on your child's behalf and making sure they're getting what they need, I think is really important. But I think the other part is really looking at a role and deciding before you say yes, if it's what your child should do. Because I have also been in situations where down the line you don't feel comfortable with material. And P.S., I wouldn't feel comfortable with my child doing the material, but I didn't say yes. Mm-hmm. And so I think there is a bit of a responsibility to, if you have concerns with a role, that, you know, you're not going to usually run into this with Disney or Nickelodeon, but, you know, we have a very large young actor cast on a number of the, you know, HBO projects and some other projects that I have that, the material's rough. TV's dark right now. TV's dark. And there's a lot of incredibly exciting, like look at 11, look at Stranger Things, look at some of those roles. If you're not comfortable with your child doing some of that stuff, I think that's the hardest part to me, is you either say yes and they could be the next big thing, or you say no. And I don't know if that's weird advice to give parents, but I just think that, like, have a conversation and decide if you want to do the role or not.
I think it's brilliant advice, and people don't talk about this enough. I think there's a general sense when you're starting to get into the industry that you have to say yes to everything, mm-hmm. and that's just not true. And to me, in my experience, the important thing is for parents and kids to get aligned on that. Like, yeah. You might or you might not be in the exact same place in terms of where you draw a line. You know, the kid might be comfortable with things that the parents aren't, or vice versa. Right. You want to find out where those lines are. And then you want to communicate that to your kid's agent and manager so that they don't even send you scripts that have stuff like that in them.
Yeah.
So you don't even get to that place where, like, oh, I got the role, but I have to say no now that I've read the script.
Yeah, well, because you're not also doing... You're not doing your child a favor. You're not doing... Like, by being uncomfortable on the day... And all of a sudden, you know, you're in a position where there's not enough time, all these decisions are being made, money's being spent. No one's trying to mistreat a child, ever. You know, I truly believe that everyone goes into this industry trying to, you know, create entertainment. And sometimes that creates dark roles for children.
Yeah.
And so I try to have early conversations with the parents of actors on my set, on, you know, sets that I'm on. Making sure they know the material that we're shooting tomorrow, making sure they understand what's happening. And look, there's so many laws and rules. Like, you're not going to be putting kids in sexual situations. Like, you're very, that's good. But just, I think, dark situations.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's my, you know, as I come out of, you know, Disney and Nickelodeon projects and move into much, I think, darker, more mature material that still features a lot of young actors, I think about that a lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's brilliant advice. It's just sort of heads up.
Yeah.
You know, heads up, parents. These are conversations that if you're not having them, they may be coming your way, or maybe you should be having them.
Yeah.
You know, because that's part of the deal. It's just like part of being responsible so that you always feel good about what's going on.
I think that's the heads up. It's like, if I bet most kids, and I could be totally wrong, when they start young, think that it means Disney, Nickelodeon, Netflix, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden these other roles come along. And so I think you're right, having those conversations early and create the same guidelines you probably would with your kid at home about what they get to do with their friends and what they would do. This is just the next thing that you're doing together in their lives.
Yeah, which puts it in a normal parent-child context, you know, and okay, it's just a slightly different conversation, mm-hmm. but it's about what's okay, what's not okay, what's comfortable, what's not comfortable, where is that line? Let's yeah. stay on the right side of it. And it's true. I do think, and in my experience, it's been borne out that many kids think that if they're going to be actors, their projects are going to look a lot like Disney and Nickelodeon. But the truth is, there is work for children in this industry on every different kind of project. HBO, Showtime, R-rated movies, whatever. Yeah. And if you're a genuine working child actor, you get those auditions randomly mixed in with the occasional Disney and Nick audition.
Absolutely.
And those are going to come your way. And you want to know beforehand, yeah. just like any other parenting and child situation, before it happens,
right.
what's the better choice to make that you're going to be happy with?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And every family's different that way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I love that. That's great advice. Thank you.
Probably a little different advice. Clearly, I've been doing Blumhouse. And
no, but you're a mom.
Yeah.
And you're a producer. And you have done all these different kinds of projects. And I think you come from a really grounded, eyes-open place on that.
Well, I think I've been thinking about it also because there's an actress who was in Ouija 2 for Blumhouse. And then we just cast her in Sharp Objects, Lulu Wilson. And, I mean, you can't leave Ouija 2 without talking about Lulu. I mean, the entire campaign is around. She's magnificent. She's so talented. And, I mean, that's a very scary movie. She has to do a lot of, you know, I'm sure, scary things. I mean, the fun part about doing scary movies is they're not scary while you're shooting them, right?
Right.
So you really, like, it's not as bad on this side. But, and then we saw her audition for Marion. She's the, she's one of the daughters in the family. So, and we saw her audition came through, and I got so excited because I knew how much I loved Lulu, but how much Jason Blum loved Lulu, and Terry Taylor, the head of casting at Blumhouse, like, I knew how much everyone loved Lulu. And, of course, everyone at Sharp Objects responded the same way. But it was so exciting kind of seeing her and her mom show up on set because, I mean, they're just, not only are they professional, incredibly, you know, this is what they do, it's all that, like, she's such a pro, but here she is in another dark role, and watching her have so much levity and lightness between takes, and, you know, it's not bringing her down. You know, mm-hmm. this is a job for her.
Mm-hmm.
But they clearly have had a conversation about what material they're comfortable with. She's also doing, I think, a Fox family comedy. So to your point, it's not like the different, you know, opportunities aren't coming in. They're clearly doing something right.
That's so cool. Well, anything else you'd like to share while we're sitting here together?
No, I just I think it's great that you're providing this as a resource, because I can only imagine how much there is to know and how little there is to get your hands on as you're a parent kind of starting to navigate this. So great job.
Thank you. It's so good to see you.
It's amazing.
And thanks for taking the time.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Hometown to Hollywood. If you enjoy this podcast, subscribe. Go to BonnieJWallace.com and sign up on the podcast page to get exclusive, inspirational stories and insider info sent to your inbox every week. If you need help figuring out just how to navigate the career of a young actor, buy my book, The Hollywood Parents Guide, on Amazon. And for one-on-one coaching that can save you literally thousands of dollars and months and years of wasted time, book an hour consultation with me over Skype or in LA. Just go to BonnieJWallace.com and click on the consultation page. For about the same price of an hour with an acting coach, you can get peace of mind and a detailed action plan. Thanks. Remember, the future belongs to those who believe in their dreams.